depends on how the news is announced. First, that weapon deliveries to the Middle East and Asia has fueled conflicts. Then, the flow of arms to the conflict-ridden Middle East more than doubled over the past 5 years. Another headline, nearly half of U.S. arms exports go to the Middle East. Well, in this debate, we'll break down SIPRI's report, which also says that Saudi Arabia is the world's second biggest importer, and how the U.S. and European countries, including Germany, supplied the bulk of these weapons. Well, guests joining us for this edition of the debate, we have managing editor at Veterans Today, Jim Dean, who joins us from Atlanta. We have founder of the American Institute for Foreign Policy, Michael Lane, who joins us from Washington, D.C. I'd like to welcome you both, and let me first start with you, Michael Lane. We're looking at this report by SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, and we can draw highlights from it, but it's interesting how this news was presented. We're looking at what it has said, the global transfer of major weapons systems between 2013 and 2017, rising by 10% compared with the five-year period before that. One of the things that it highlights is that the U.S. exports has grown significantly. Why do you think U.S. exports have grown significantly? And whether you agree with this report or not in the first place.
Well, I have no reason at this point to take issue with the report. I haven't really had the chance to delve into it 100%, but from skimming all the top lines fairly thoroughly, it looks like it's reasonably accurate based on commonly available data. So I'll stipulate for the time being that it's in the ballpark enough to discuss. As far as whether or what is the driving cause of this, well, I think there's a multitude of factors. Number one, there's a lot of things going on around the world that require replacement and refreshment of military arms. Certainly, when you look at the report, it focuses and hones in very much on the United States aid to or sales to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is involved in a very serious conflict in Yemen, as well as supplying some other friends of theirs. And so their need to refresh, replenish, and modernize their military forces or their military weaponry is ongoing. So that's one driving factor. Another driving factor is the United States has had a very long-standing military alliance with Saudi Arabia based on mutually pledged security. And even though arms sales did increase slightly during the Obama years, when President Trump came in, he decided that he was going to correct what he saw as a narrowing of the pipeline, open it up, and provide Saudi Arabia with the weapons they think they need to provide for their own security. President Trump feels that if Saudi Arabia is able to provide mostly for its own security, then the United States will not be drawn into any conflict.
Okay.
The third thing I would say is that there's one more thing, and that is the economic aspects of it. There's no doubt that President Trump, when he came into office, said that he was looking for a strengthening not only of security but economic relationships and alliances with countries around the world. He specifically mentioned the Middle East. He made a trip to the Middle East during which those were discussed and negotiated and concluded. And so the economic benefits of Saudi Arabia purchasing their necessary arms for the United States is another leg in the stool.
Just a quick question. In between what you were saying there, Michael Lane, did I understand you correctly that you said when the U.S. sells weapons to Saudi Arabia, that Saudi Arabia also has to provide weapons? I heard you say to their friends. I'm not too sure I follow that. Who are you referring to?
For there are certain elements. I would say particularly those in Syria, but perhaps others that were not as high profile or something like that, that are allied with Saudi Arabia in terms of what their overall viewpoint and objectives are in that particular theater. And it wouldn't surprise me at all, although it's never been admitted to and it's never been confirmed, it wouldn't be surprise me at all if some of Saudi Arabia's military resources wound up aiding those particular groups.
Okay, Jim Dean, you know, if you can respond to Michael Lane, and if you can, Jim Dean, I'm looking over here in terms of the cycle here. You have the seller, and then you have the people who are buying it, or the countries that are buying it, in order for them to use it. So walk us through that, if you can, in your interpretation, also combined with what Michael Lane there has said.
Well, we have the age-old deal Beginning, roughly can go back to the beginning, the U.S. got interested in pouring arms into Saudi Arabia simply for a balance of trade effort. We were buying a lot of oil from them at that point, and they wanted to sell them as much domestic infrastructure and also weapons to cover that. So that was a very normal business type arrangement back then. But fast forward to today, where you have the Mideast as a flashpoint, and then you have U.S. industry, particularly the arms industry, wanting to keep the engines of war going because the number of things that they sell, the unit costs that the U.S. has to pay for copies of these same weapons goes down, the bigger the runs are on them. So they have a very vested interest to having conflicts and creating situations where they can sell these arms. And we see some of this going on now. But then I would like to comment this situation where if a Saudi Arabia has enough arms, it can defend itself and not get involved in any wars in the Mideast. And I just thought that's completely baloney because coming with the U.S. arms is if Saudi Arabia got into a pinch, they certainly have the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force and NASA and all of the satellites. All of that is coming with the package because Saudi Arabia has actually bought way more weapons than it can actually use. It doesn't have the Army or the Air Force really to put these things into the field. One of the hidden scandals about the Saudi Air Force, most of the pilots are Pakistani stand-ins. Saudi pilots get about $300,000 a year, and most of them just hire a Pakistani pilot to fly their plane for them. Just like Saudi Arabia is using a lot of mercenaries now in Yemen, they don't like to take casualties. The tribes, everybody wants to hire someone out to do the fighting. This is one of the reasons that the Yemen war has been going on. So everybody's using everybody. Everybody wants to make money and have some poor schlep actually have to do the work. And then the last aspect of it, the key to keep all of this going is you've got to have a boogeyman. You've got to have a threat. And here we are one more time, Iran being cast as the boogeyman when having been under sanctions for so many years, also needs to modernize its military and have some credible defense in the face of this huge amounts of weapons that the U.S. has sold to its allies, who have been very, very aggressive in what they've said about Iran. This is building a powder keg, and the key to this, we hear endless recriminations about Iran is the biggest sponsor of terrorism, and they're trying to destabilize the Middle East and whatever, and we see absolutely nothing involved in that at all, except trying to help people in countries that have been targeted for regime change themselves to not be taken over by the U.S. and the Saudi coalition.
So let's hone in on that last part there, Michael, and that Jim Dean said. Aside from getting into the politics of Iran and how it's being viewed, is there a boogeyman that needs to be part of the equation of selling arms to countries in the region and regimes like Saudi Arabia?
Well, I don't think it necessarily needs to be a boogeyman. I think it needs to be an identified, valid adversary. Certainly, when you look at the Middle East theater in total, Iran and Saudi Arabia are adversarial in their relationships with each other. Iran has had a lot of success recently with the cash infusions and the economic recovery that they've had to date since the sanctions have been removed, where they've been able to build their military, where they've been able to send military and foreign aid to other entities, proxies of theirs, if you will, et cetera. And so the theater, or the immediate threat is expanding, and Saudi Arabia, not necessarily referring to Iran as the boogeyman, but merely as the adversary, is making the case that they need to be prepared on multiple fronts to fight multiple types of conflicts, And so therefore they are modernizing and expanding their military, and that has a lot to do with what is going on with the arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Again, I don't want to take off the table the economic relationship or the other things, but the security needs of Saudi Arabia as they see it, and the threat that they feel from their adversarial relationship with Iran is a large part driving force.
Wasn't there at one point, Jim Dean, that U.S. President Donald Trump said, you know, the Saudis are not paying enough. They're not paying enough for us to keep them secured, to provide them security. Does this reflect somewhat on this arms sales?
It does so, but it also shows something about Trump's background, New York City, and his working very closely with the Italian mafia when he built his real estate empire. About protection rackets. And if you want protection, you got to be able to pay for it. I was really surprised he would bring up something so crude like that with his background. But the issue in terms of the arms, I think, is also very important here, is what are the arms really for? Are they for offensive? Are you trying to build up enough to have an offensive capability? So in a war or a war on multiple fronts, you can absorb losses and still have enough to take territory and hold it? Or do you need a lesser situation where you're perceiving yourself to be in a defensive position and you just need to have something to retaliate and to be able to defend your own borders? And this is something that's always left out with these fake analysts with Iran and also with Russia. Is Iran has really no avenues to really attack anyone other than Iraq, which it's never wanting to do. So it does not need the massive military spending to be what we call project military power. You need massive air transport. You need naval forces that are completely secure. You need a huge, huge air force to protect these things if you're transporting arms and troops, and they don't have any of that really, and they have absolutely no plans to spend themselves into oblivion building anything like that. And they're doing just like the famous Putin speech made, is we are a smaller country, we're being spent out 10 to 1 by NATO and the US. We have to save every dime that we spend on military power on defense. We have to have a credible retaliation defense, and we have to be able to defend our borders. And that's what they're doing. And that's what the US and the Western coalition doesn't like. So they've absolutely made up this whole thing that they're a threat, when really what they're doing is they're not going to get into an arms race and undercut their domestic development by spending five times as much on military than they need to, because all they need is a strong, credible defense.
Well, Michael Lane, you know, there's a camp out there, and there's some that believe that the U.S., and I have to say Israel, have plans for the Middle East. They call it the vision that they have, where they need to keep this area in conflict. There needs to be wars maintained here because they want to see this region, forget about Iraq being partitioned in terms of a U.S. proposal from Joseph Biden days, but they want the region to be broken up into smaller parts. And the more there's war, the better it is, and it's to the benefit of Israel. What can you say to those people who have that viewpoint, Michael Lane?
Well, I think that's a dated viewpoint, in my judgment. There was, you know, clearly the smaller the entities that might be your adversaries that surround you in your neighborhood, the easier they would be to defend yourself against. It's when an entity becomes larger, stronger, more powerful, more rich, more well-armed, that it becomes more of a serious threat. But in my judgment, in recent years, Israel has done a pretty good job in terms of conducting foreign policy that reaches out to other states within the region, and now has, you know, if you can't go so far as to call them alliances, they certainly have a very, very good, a very good relationship with many of the Arab countries in the Middle East. And by playing that card and developing and cultivating those relationships, The bigger and the stronger they are, the safer and more secure Israel might be. Now, as far as your adversaries are concerned, yes, it's always a good idea to have them broken up, diminished, made smaller, etc. But that's not just necessarily a military strategy. That's just the way life is.
Well, talk about Israel over here, Jim Dean. I think they had the biggest military deal ever in their history. And that happened under Obama's watch. As a matter of fact, it should be mentioned that this SIPRI report talks about how these deals were signed under Obama, and they were based on the arms deliveries for the period 2013 through 2017, reaching their highest level since the late 1990s. Now, Israel is pumped up with arms. You have Saudi Arabia, you have its allies, you have the UAE, and here we have Iran that's surrounded by the U.S., and yet they have a problem with Iran's missiles. So try to figure that out. But what do you think about the fact that this region is being fueled by arms in order to keep conflicts going? Jim Dean.
Oh, I certainly agree with that. And because you got to have fear to have people be manipulated, desire for gain or fear of loss. And one thing, if I might mention, with that budget, big budget for Israel, even though under Obama, when they switched over to the 10-year plan, and that was, by the way, to protect that if you got a hostile Washington new regime in that wanted to cut back on Israel's arms, they couldn't do it because they had a 10-year thing going on. But what you really had here is a lot of that money. I've mentioned this on the show before, that Israel has 10 missile silos for their intercontinental ICBMs with multiple warheads that can reach the U.S., they can reach Moscow, and reach Beijing. And we have to ask ourselves, why in the world would Israel need intercontinental missiles? Also, that India has worked very closely with them on building. When they say they're really concerned about their regional enemies. And this is never, ever mentioned in the U.S. press whatsoever. And then in terms of another side aspect of this is it's come out now that one of the hidden stories in this is Prince Bandar, the intelligence chief of Saudi Arabia, was really the architect, not the U.S., of using extremist terrorist groups for destabilization in the Mideast. And the reason for this also hasn't been covered. And that is the Saudis long term were very nervous about any Arab states basically building themselves as progressive democratic states. They would have bad examples to their own authoritarian rule. So one of the reasons they put billions and billions of dollars into this terrorist program to insert these people in all of the Arab countries that had any chance of having to make sure that any progressive movements there could be combated with and hopefully replaced by having a jihadi and extremist regimes. And of course, the U.S. was completely on board that with their divide and conquer routine. So even though Saudi Arabia was giving these people a lot of aid, it was also financing all of the extremist Islamists in their country.
Okay.
And the numbers are absolutely phenomenal.
I got to give 30 seconds to you each. Michael Lane, 30 seconds, perhaps not a lot of time, but the reports that exposed how the CIA ran weapons to terrorists. Now, this is something that is provided by this independent journalist by the name of, let me get this right, her name is, 1 second here, Bulgarian journalist by the name of Dilyana Kazimyashiev. She came out with a report saying that the U.S., actually through Saudi Arabia, provided lots of arms to these terrorists. Do you think that a lot of U.S. arms ended up on terrorist hands? 30 seconds.
A lot is a undefined term. It would not surprise me to find out that some U.S. weapons wound up in the hands of people who were fighting the Syrian regime. There's been an ongoing debate between the West and countries in the theater, Syria, Russia, as to whether or not they are terrorists or whether they're rebels or freedom fighters or whatever. But no, it doesn't surprise me to hear that there would be some level of United States arms that would wind up in the hands of people who were fighting the Syrian regime.
Okay, and final question goes to you, Jim Dean. And I'm not going to take credit for this question. Cipri actually itself said, if you have violence in the Middle East and you have concerns about human rights, why not talk about it politically and arms sales to be restricted?
Well, because no one is going to listen to you. The buyers are going to want to buy them, and the sellers are going to want to sell them. The Russian weapons came in from the Balkans and Ukraine, from the old Soviet manufacturing facilities, and the modern stuff like the TOW missiles and whatever, they were transferred from Saudi Arabia, Qatar's and
right.
Israel stocks.
Very
and that's
good.
Where the mix of the
jump
weapons
in.
Came
Sorry.
From.
Sorry. Thank you. Managing Editor of Enters Today, Jim Dean. Thank you. Founder of the American Institute for Foreign Policy, Michael Lane. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. For me, Kovitao, and the entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.